Hi, this is Dave Spray. Welcome to the podcast. I just finished a great interview with Paul Liberato, and there were a couple things in the interview that were really interesting. One is that he joined this company when he was in his late 20s as the president, and he didn't know anything about the industry. And because of that, he really relied on just learning from his customers. And from that, some of their best ideas came from just listening to their customers. And it was just interesting hearing the story for the last 32 years on some of their best products were situations where their customers came to them with a problem, asking them if they could come up with a solution. And so I think there's some interesting lessons to be learned about having really strong customer and supplier relationships and how that makes the company stronger in the end. So I hope you enjoy this interview as much as I did. And thanks again, as always, for listening to the podcast. Well, my guest today is Paul Liberato, the president of Billy Pugh Company. And I've been really excited, looking forward to having Paul on the podcast. And so, Paul, welcome to the show.
Thanks, David. Appreciate it.
Yeah. So I do this different way. Sometimes I just read somebody's bio, and sometimes I like to just kind of walk through it. So I decided to take the second approach for the interview today. And partially I did this because I don't know your entire backstory, even though I've known you for, nearly two decades. So why don't we start at the beginning? Where are you a native Texan?
No, my father was a Navy fighter pilot, and my two brothers and I were, actually Frank is one of my brothers. He worked with me at Billy Pugh Company for a while. We'll talk about him a little bit later. And then, he was born in Jacksonville, Florida, along with my brother Mark. And then my sister and I were born in Pensacola, Florida, while my dad was, out on the aircraft carriers. And just depending on which, carrier he was on, one of the carrier groups was based out of Jacksonville and one out of Pensacola. And then, eventually he actually went out to San Diego. So we were out in California for a while too, but we moved to Texas when I was, I think about 5 years old, and he retired from the Navy and took a job in the aerospace industry. He was a safety flight specialist, kind of an aeronautical engineer, but he built safety features onto jet aircraft when he got done. So, pretty smart guy, a Naval Academy graduate, and he loved the Navy, he loved flying, so. Anyway, but yeah, so we mostly grew up in Texas and
in what part? What part of Texas? Then?
Arlington, right outside of Fort Worth.
Sure.
Yeah. Growing up, it's funny. Nobody ever heard of Arlington, but after the Rangers got there, and now the Texas Stadium is there, everybody knows about Arlington. But when we moved there in the early '60s, I think it was 6,000 or 8,000 people there total.
Oh wow!
So it was a pretty small place.
And then I understand that when it came time for college, you were drawn west to the Great Plains of West Texas, huh?
Yeah.
The High Plains.
I've always been, really serious about my academics. And when my brother Mark went to Texas Tech and I saw how many pretty girls were there, I knew that was the place for me. And so that was kind of when you're 17, that's kind of the main reason. But no, Tech was a great place. I loved going there. My youngest son went there. It's a wonderful school. And there's really, when you're out in West Texas, there's really nothing else to do. If you go to UT, you got Austin and you got all the beautiful hill country around you. A&M kind of the same thing. If you go to Tech, you better like Tech because that's all there is out there. Texas Tech and sure. The rest is high plains and desert. But I loved it up there. My brother Frank went there. My brother Mark went there, and it's a great place to go to college.
That is that's great. And for those people not from Texas, that's Texas Tech's in Lubbock, Texas, out in West Texas on the High Plains. So you graduated from Texas Tech. What was your degree in?
I double majored in communications and history, and I had a minor in economics.
Okay.
And I kept changing because what I wanted to do was I wanted to be a TV sportscaster. So I've always loved sports, and I ended up my last few years I had to put myself through college, So I wasn't able to do an internship. And back in those days, and probably still, I don't know, but it was really difficult to get on anywhere if you didn't do an internship. But since I had to work full time as a bartender and a waiter, I didn't have time to do an internship. So I added the economics part on the bottom. I thought maybe that would help me get a job. And so I graduated from 1982 and didn't really know what I wanted to do. So I just applied around and I ended up going to work for a Fortune 500 company called Deluxe. They printed checks for banks.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, great company. They called us Little Blue. It was because we were a lot like IBM. It's just a
big blue, which was big blue. Yeah.
Yeah. They were big blue. We were little blue. But it was a great company. Man, I learned so much working for Deluxe. I worked for so many great people. And it was just a first class organization from top to bottom. And I mean, even then, I left there, Deluxe. I started working in 82. I left in 89. But a lot of the stuff that I still incorporate into my business and to how I operate, I learned from Deluxe. That was just a wonderful experience. And so I started with Deluxe in Dallas as a sales trainee. And then I had my first sales territory in Dallas. And then I was there for about a year or two. And I got transferred to Seattle, Washington, and took over the major accounts in Seattle for a couple of years. That's where I got married and had my first child, a boy. And then I got promoted again into the management group in Los Angeles. We were companies based in Minneapolis, but we had a regional headquarters in LA. And so I went down and joined the management group in LA. I was there for a couple of years and they moved me to San Francisco, where I was taking care of Bank of America and Wells Fargo for the company, which were our two largest customers. And then I got recruited to be West Coast Marketing Vice President for MasterCard. So I worked for MasterCard for a while. And all during this, I was in communication with a family friend of ours from Corpus Christi. And he was giving me information on a new company called Billy Pugh Company.
This would be Jimmy Storm. Is that Jimmy, right?
Yeah, it sure was. Yeah, with Jimmy Storm. And Mr. Storm was a friend of ours. And he anyway contacted me and said, hey, would you be interested in taking a look? A friend of mine is selling this company. He's got a great reputation. They did make good products. And I think I can help you put something together. And so I was 29 years old and flew to Corpus Christi and met Billy Pugh. And he's a very interesting character. Great story. I mean, there's tons of great stories about Billy Pugh, but he was definitely kind of that old school offshore oil guy. And he was, sure. You know, he kind of grew up with Red Adair and of course, Mr. Storm, Gus Glasscock. I mean, a lot of the pioneers in the offshore oil and gas business, those guys were a different breed. So I had a chance to meet Billy, and then we were able to put together a group of investors, and I sold everything I had, retirement houses, everything, to put my money in. And I got there in the summer of 89, and we went live with our management group and taking over the company October 2nd of 1989. I just turned 30.
Wow. So what do you think Mr. Storm saw in you, given that you didn't have, an oil and gas background, given your relatively young age, still in your 20s, what do you think he saw in you that he thought you'd be the right guy for this?
You know, it's a funny story, but there was actually a specific event. He had actually come out to California for a Wildcatters convention in Carmel. And we lived in a play area called San Ramon, which is where Chevron's headquartered, east of San Francisco, south of Walnut Creek. Anyway, he came out to visit. He spent the night and I told him, well, I'll just drive you down to Carmel the next day. It was not that far. So he hopped in the car and we were driving down, and that was back in the days when we used dictaphones. I don't know if you ever saw a dictaphone or not.
Yep.
But so I was the only guy I knew. This was 1988. I actually had a car phone back then, and that was a big deal. But it was one of those phones that was attached to the floor of your car. And so I'm dictating letters. And of course, this is, you know, these days, it's really not considered a good thing to be multitasking while you're driving. But
sure.
That was before anybody really paid much attention to that. But I was dictating letters, talking on my cell phone, driving the car and talking to him all at the same time. And we pulled up to Carmel and we pulled over and he said, "Well, that was the most amazing thing I've ever seen." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "I was watching you do all these things all at the same time and you were doing them all pretty well." And I said, "Well, I appreciate that." And he said, "That, I'm just curious." He said, "Have you ever thought about running your own company? You just look like the kind of guy that would be good at that." And I said, "Man, I think every young person would like an opportunity to work for themselves and be an entrepreneur." And he said, "Well, if I run into the right situation," he said, I'll let you know." I said, "Well, that would be great." And I really thought he was just being, you know, polite. And he, I don't, for the people that have ever met Jimmy Storm, they'll tell you he was one of the kindest people you could ever meet, and a highly successful guy, very well known, but also one of the kindest and most thoughtful people you'd ever meet. And so anyway, I just thought he was being Mr. Storm, just being a nice guy. And I don't know, maybe a few weeks later, 3-4 weeks later, he called up and he said, "Hey, that, remember we talked about that on the car?" I said, "Yeah." He goes, "Well, hop on a plane. I want you to come take a look at something." So I flew down and Billy Pugh, and he picked me up at the airport and we went out and ate barbecue and talked about the offshore oil and gas business, which I knew absolutely zero about. It all worked out. It was, it was one of those things that was really funny because a lot of people ask, you know, what made you think you would be a success in a business that you didn't know anything about? And I think like a lot of things, it just was really common sense. I mean, you know, how do you treat your customers? How do you treat your employees? Are you honest? Do you handle your finances conservatively? Do you do business in an above board manner? A lot of the stuff that I learned from Deluxe. And one of the beautiful things about it was my brother Frank came to work with me. I'm not an operations guy. Frank is very much an operations guy. And I knew I needed somebody to help me. And so I'd been there not quite a year and hired Frank on. And one of the beautiful things about our relationship was that he felt the same way I did. You know, growing up in the same household, we kind of had the same value system. And we never, you know, in all the years, I think Frank worked with me for he's retired now, but probably 28 or 9 years. And I don't think we had more than really a half a dozen disagreements. It's just
a great
relationship. And like I said, we were always thinking the same. And like I said, it turned out to be a great situation for us.
That is, that's great. And thank you for that background. And I guess the company, Billy Pugh had founded the company about 30 years earlier than that, right? I think in the 50s.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, I'm just about to pass him up. There's only been two presidents of Billy Pugh County, Billy Pugh and me. And he started in 57 to 89.
89.
Yeah, 32 years. And then I started in 89 and 2021 will be 32 years. So, I've just about caught up to him. It's amazing, you know, how fast it's gone. I mean, I just can't believe that it's been that long. You can do the math on the, you know, I've actually been president of Billy Pugh Company longer than I took over.
Yeah. I was just going to say. So I guess at some point you're going to have to find you a sharp young 29-year-old to sell this thing to, I suppose, huh?
Yeah. You know, somebody's got to take it over, you know, it's like Billy told me when I took over, he said, a new broom always sweeps clean, you know? And so I guess I was the new broom, you know? And so maybe that's what we need. We need a new broom, I guess, around this place. We've still got, I tell you the funny part about our company too, David, you'll get a kick out of this is, we were having our normal Christmas party this year and I told everybody, I said, you know, I just turned 31 years and I said, how many people have been here longer than me? And you couldn't believe how many hands went up. I mean, we have so
really?
Many people worked for us for 30 plus years. We have one individual, that's worked for us for, well over 50 years, Ramiro.
Wow.
Starting when he was 18, he's 73. So he's worked for us for 55 years. We have a lot of people that work for us in the 30s. And so the good news is, you know, we have a lot of wonderful tenured employees. The tough news is they're all kind of like me. They're all kind of getting older. So, you know, we're trying to bring people in and the best we can to kind of refresh them. But golly, you know, they just continue to do a wonderful job, and we're so blessed to have them.
Now that is great. So, what the heck is an X904? I was on your website and I saw that, but I couldn't really make heads nor tails of it. What the heck is an X904, and what does it do?
Well, it pays all the bills.
Okay.
It's an interesting story, because when we took over the company, you know, Billy Pugh, I have to back up just a little bit so I can give you some perspective on how this thing got going. Because there's the next 904 actually has a parent, and that's called an X870. And that parent was born in the 50s, and it was Billy was working as a deckhand in offshore Corpus Christi, and working on a drilling rig called the Mr. Gus. And he saw some guys getting transferred from the boat up to the drilling platform, and they were using a cargo net, if you can imagine. So they took the crane, they attached the four legs of a cargo net, set it down, and the guys would basically just kind of hang on the best they could onto this cargo net. They'd pick them up, and then they would untangle themselves, you know, when they got up on deck and when they dropped them down on the boat. And Billy was watching that, and he came up to the superintendent. He said, "Man, that really looks like a dangerous thing to do. I think I've got an idea that will make it safer." And that was before the days of stop work authority, you know, when you can stop jobs. So basically, they just told him to get back to work or go find something else to do. And a few days later, they had a horrific accident. I don't remember all the statistics, but I know at least a couple of people got killed and some injuries as well. So.
From the very same activity?
Exactly. Yeah, they were transferring some guys over, and I think they dropped them on the deck. And anyway, it was a fatality accident. So they went and they found Billy and said, "Okay, you were telling us the other day about this idea you had. Why don't you go out and show us what you got?" So Billy went home and he made the first personnel transfer device, and he called it an X871. And that became really the industry standard until about 2008 or 10. And that's what people used all over the world. It's one of those kind of things, David. It's kind of like a Coca-Cola or a Kleenex tissue or a Xerox copy. I mean, no matter what kind of transfer device you use offshore, it's a Billy Pugh, and the name is synonymous with the activity that it's doing. And so, kind of get back to the X904.
But hey, Paul, before you go there, so the predecessor, you're saying that predecessor product was basically used for 50 years, huh? Or 45 years?
Yeah.
47
yeah,
years. Did it have a patent or anything? What made it so?
Durable. Patent ran out, I think, in the 80s, Dave. But, you know, we were so well known, and I just don't think those safety guys wanted to be the guy that said, "Hey, you know, we can save 20% if we use this copy product," and then, and then have an accident, you know. So they knew that the industry standard, they knew we built from the best quality products, and that, you know, we don't really have any, you know, we really are, the accident rate that we had was so incredibly safe, and we really, you know, we've never had a structure related accident on one of our products. So
I see. There used to be a saying, you know, a few decades ago in the IT world that nobody got fired for buying IBM.
Right.
And it sounds like that was the case with Billy Pugh. Nobody got fired for buying Billy Pugh products.
You know what? It's funny you say that, because I really do. I think that has come up before. I think I've been in meetings where somebody actually used that term and said, you know, you never get fired for buying Billy Pugh. So that's funny. I've forgotten about that, actually, but I have heard that. And they've used us in that context. So, but it was, it was a good product. You know, worked for years. It was a very safe product. But, you know, as things, you know, move along with everything else, people want improvements and they want things that are better. And so we got approached by one of the major drillers, which was Diamond Offshore, and one of the major operators, BP, and approached us to say, you know, look, there's some other things coming out of the market right now that have some features that are appealing to us. We really like working with Billy Pugh Company. We really like most of the things around the current product that we use, but, you know, we'd really like to see if you could develop something that would be similar to what we have, but to incorporate some of the safety features that might help to become a better product. So Frank and I immediately got to work on it. We spent a lot of time just talking to people, and it was kind of a two-pronged approach. We talked to people from all the major drillers. We talked about major operators. We talked to crane operators. You know, what do you like? What do you not like? You know, do you want to stand up? Do you want to sit down? Do you want to face in? Do you want to face out? Do you want to have a seatbelt on? There's lots of options and hanging below a crane and getting transferred back and forth. And so one of the things that we did as well, which we really found to be helpful, is we went back through all the accident data and tried to figure out, okay, when accidents did occur, and there's not a lot of them, but there was some, you know, what was happening that was creating these problems and these people getting hurt. And really we came up with three major areas, which was people were either falling off, where we had a guy years ago that had a heart attack while he was being transferred and he fell off, and thank goodness he survived. But we've had people that the crane operator, let's say it's really heavy winds and the basket starts to swing. Well, we've had people that where the crane operator swung the basket into a hard point, like a leg of a rig or a leg of a platform, okay, or a handrail, and they're riding on the outside of this thing. And then the third one, there was something going on about then in the industry called the DROPS program, where there was a real emphasis on things falling from overhead, landing on people. And so we really didn't have any data that showed anybody had been hurt by something falling on them during a personnel transfer, but we knew that the potential was there because you've got all that rigging over your head. So okay, those were the three things that we concentrated on. And what we wanted to create a scenario where it was as similar as possible to the X871, because people love the X871. The guys offshore never wanted to change. They just liked that product. I just had a guy tell me from one of the rigs, and I was talking to a guy from Australia a couple of days ago, and just told me, you know, I really like this X904, but I really miss the old rope baskets because I just enjoyed riding those things. So, I mean, it was a great product, but, you know, we wanted to improve on it, and we did find some areas where we could improve. So we made it as close to possible, but we incorporated these additional safety features. And what we did, on the old 870 models, they were made out of rope on the perimeter. So they had vertical ropes that were collapsible. And so the basket would come out on the deck. The guys would stand on, hold on to the ropes and ride on the outside of the basket. Well, on this new one, it was very similar, but you would take a kind of a half step in. And the ropes on the outside, even though they look like normal ropes, they're actually stainless steel wire rope encased in a double braid nylon. So if you can imagine, you're stepping about a half a step in, and then you have these tensioned ropes around you. There's a tensioning device in the center, and that tightens those ropes up. And then if you swing into a hard object, would you just bounce off? Those ropes behind you.
I see.
Keep you protected. So you've got that working for you. And then we've got a grating, basically an expanded metal grating over the top of you to protect you from falling objects from above, which we didn't have on the 800 series. And then the third thing was the keeping people from falling out. And that was the trickiest one by far. That was really, really difficult because you don't want to be overly restrained in a personnel transfer. And what I mean by that is if you're going from a ship up to a platform or vice versa, you really want to be able to step away and get to a safe place as soon as possible. Because sometimes, you know, if you're 6, 8, 10 foot seas, that deck is pitching around. You don't want to be struggling trying to unhook yourself from something that might be sliding around the deck. So you want to be able to. The thing they loved about that 800 series is they could just set it down and step away and walk away. so what we came up with was a quick release carabiner. So if you can imagine, Dave, like, you know, when you jump out of an airplane and you pull the ripcord, well, that's basically what this is. You don't have to do anything to manipulate. All you have to do is pull. And it's a spring loaded 5,000 pound carabiner that attaches to the person that's riding the basket. So when they sat down, just as they sat down, they're holding onto these ropes. They pull the carabiner, it pops loose and they step away. So, you know, it might take them an extra, golly, I don't know, maybe 10th of a second or whatever to get off. So it was a good compromise. And, you know, it was kind of a funny thing. When we the 904, where the four comes from, it is that was the fourth prototype we built. And so we had a 901, a 902, a 903, and a 904. Well, the 904 was being tested on a rig called the Ocean Confidence. And I can't remember where they were operating. It may have been the Gulf of Mexico. We were working with a guy named John Auth, who was the HSC manager back in those days with Diamond, and he was critical. A bunch of guys that helped us with in the industry, my gosh. Anyway, John was helping us, and he let us test this thing on the Ocean Confidence. And so we did 100 surveys, and we asked the guys offshore to rate the basket, the Dex 904, from a 1 to a 5, 5 being excellent, 4 good, and on down, as you know. And so anyway, I don't know if you have spent much time offshore, but that's probably the toughest group of guys you're ever going to run into. I mean, just physically tough and just tough, period. They're a rough audience, if you can, if you know what I mean. It's just that's just the culture out there. So if you can make those guys happy, you've really done something. So we got our surveys back, and John called me and he said, well, you know, we got our 100 surveys. We want exactly 100. And I said, well, how'd we come out? He said, well, you got 75s and 34s and nothing below a 4. And in terms of how they rated it, then we gave him a section to write, you know, comments on. He said, Paul, they just loved it, you know. So that's when we knew we had something, and we went live with the program, and Diamond was the first one to buy them for all of their fleet. And then after that, I think just about every major driller that I'm aware of has them now. We probably sell 90% of those overseas. But kind of fun little side story, my brother Frank came up to me, and you know, Frank was a huge part of the design of this. And, you know, let me get to this part of the story, and I'll back up on the design part. But, sure. Frank came and he said, okay, so we got this new 904, you know, we're finally done with it. He goes, how many of these things do you think we'll sell? And I said, man, I don't know. I said, man, it'd be great if we could sell like 2 a month, you know? And, you know, as it turns out, you know, that's probably 70% of our business now, or 60 or 70% of our business. Trust me, it's a lot more than 2 a month. and because I just, you know, it was a paradigm change for the offshore guys. I mean, think about it. I mean, they're used to paying, you know, say $1,500, $1,600 for an X800, maybe $2,000, and now they're going to pay $18,000, $16,000, $20,000.
Oh wow.
So, you know. But what we used to tell them, you know, is it's like, God, you know, Paul, that's just so much more than what we're used to. And it's okay. So if we save one person, if we prevent one accident, you know, how's that investment look to you now? And they said, man, it looks pretty good. Well, there you go. You know,
but now was there much? Go ahead. Well, I was just going to say.
Go ahead.
Was there much resistance to the crew to the 904 versus the 800 series, or
That's a great question, man. Yeah, there was the biggest part was that restraint system, you know, and we call it man positioning, because it's really not a fall restraint. Basically, it's just it's a man positioning system to hold the guy in place so he doesn't go out of the basket. I was at an oil show in Lafayette. And my phone rang, and the guy said, you know, this is the HSC manager for the rig. I forgot which drilling contractor it was. And we're doing a test on the X904. And quite frankly, one of our guys won't get on it. And I said, I don't know how this guy got my number, but he did. He said, would you mind talking to him? And I said, no, put him on. So this guy was a coonass, and I'm not going to, a coonass is a word that people use offshore for people from Louisiana. It's not a derogatory term for people that aren't familiar. So he was, we'll call him a Cajun. Okay. So this Cajun says, he says, "Mr. Liberato, I'm not riding in no crab trap." And, I said, "What did you say?" So he goes, "It looks like a crab trap to me." And I said, "Well, it's not." He says, "I like the old ones. Why did you have to change?" And I said, "Well, just try it." I said, "Just let them pick you up and try it." And I said, "If you don't like it, you don't have to do it anymore." I said, because I knew he'd like it. And I said, "Just try it. And then if you have a problem, call me back." So anyway, I never heard back. So I'm assuming everything went fine and they ended up, you know, buying the product. But I just thought that was the funniest thing when the guy, you know, in that very, very heavy Cajun accent told me he didn't want to ride in a crab trap.
So how long did it take? Was it like 6 months or a year before the guys who initially didn't like it because of the restraint that they kind of warmed up to the idea, or
no,
did,
you know,
the old timers never warm up to it?
No, you know what? Honestly, I, we had for a big a change as it was, we had very little resistance. I mean, it was, you know, we did a lot of surveys even after we went live with the product. You know, we still had to get these other companies on board, and so I just kept the same surveys that I used when we were developing it, and we got so many positive comments. I mean, so many positive comments, and it was just, you know, the X904 is the best thing in the world for what it's designed to do. It just is, you know, and so the pushback was unbelievable in terms of how minimal it was. And the reason why, and that's kind of what I was going to get at a second ago. The reason why is that we've been asked a million times, my brother and I, you know, how did you guys come up with this? You know, that was really something. And we kind of did, and we kind of didn't. What we did is we're just good listeners. We spent 2 years researching and developing this thing, 2 years. And we talked to literally probably 1,000 people. And it was hundreds and hundreds. And I bet it was 1,000 people. I would have luncheons, you know, for the drilling contractors. And we just talk, you know, bring the crane operators in, bring the rig hands in, bring the roustabouts, roughnecks, and just say, what do you like? What do you not like? What do you want? And we learned so much from that. And then when we started building the prototypes, that really helped, because we'd take those and we would test them. And then they would come back and say, look, I didn't like this. I did like this. And so basically, yeah, I mean, we did design the thing, but, you know, we literally had 1,000 people helping us. So I think that's why the pushback was so minimal, is because we didn't rush to get it to market. And we really spent a lot of time making sure that it was exactly what was needed for the application that it was going to be used for.
Okay. Well, yeah, that's, you know, it's kind of a novel idea, right? To ask your customer what they want and then give it to them, as opposed to just building something and then try to convince them to buy it. Okay. So, and that was, what year did that come out?
You know, it was probably about 2000 and probably 8, maybe 6 or 8. I have to go back and look. So it's been around a while. But it makes up, you know, obviously the majority of our business now. And you know, it's just been a wonderful product. I mean, one of the beautiful things about Billy Pugh Company, and I can't take credit for this, it was like that when I got there, is that because we have the reputation that we have in the industry that we serve, people approach us on a regular basis with they have a problem, whether it's a, you know, they had a potential accident, or they did have an accident, or they just need something that works a little bit better. We'll get a phone call and we'll be approached by either a driller, an operator, boat company, and say, look, you know, we had this happen. You know, do you think you guys could have maybe a product-based solution that might prevent this from happening, or just create a safer situation for us? You know, we had something funny happen years ago, and it was, you know, we were fortunate. We had a few things like this come up where we just kind of backed into something really good, where when I took over the company, Billy told me, he said, you know, Paul, don't ever attach a tagline to a personnel basket. And a tagline, if you're familiar with the term, it's just something that you attach to any kind of a load below a crane, and it helps you just guide it in. It's like a rope hanging off the bottom. And then if you've got say a big basket full of something, and then the you've got a person down on the deck, whether it's the deck of a platform or even on land, and the rope will come down, then they'll grab the rope and then they'll guide the load down to the proper area that they wanted. Well, Billy told me, he said, don't ever attach one of those to a personnel basket. And I said, why not? He said, well, because that's where a lot of the accidents happen, and we don't want to be associated with that. And I thought, okay. So after Frank got there, you know, he and I got talking about it, and we were like, you know, that doesn't make any sense to us, because if they're going to attach a rope to it anyway, then we're still, you know, we've got a potential hazard out there. So let's try to figure something out that'll work better. So we came up with this. It's called a tangle resistant tagline. And basically what it does is that it the way that it's designed, it won't wrap around anything and it won't catch on anything. So those were the two major concerns, is that as your load comes down, that rope would wrap around like a handrail or anything as it was swinging around in all the wind. And then you've got a real problem on your hands, or it would catch in a pinch point. Where what happens when people have a rope that's frayed at the bottom? They tie a knot in it. So now this thing's got a knot on the end of it. Well, then it's running across the deck, and that knot hangs into something, and then you've got a problem there with the crane operator. He may not see it, and then next thing you know, he's got a tremendous amount of tension on that load, and it can create a, you know, can create a real problem. So we created this tangle resistant tagline. Well, what the funny part was is that when we built it, we just built it to attach to personnel nets. And there was a fellow that worked for Noble Drilling, their HSE manager, years ago. And he said, you know, Paul, he's still a close friend of mine, by the way. Anyway, he said, you know, why not use that on every load you have? Not just personnel baskets. You know, we were kind of looking at the trees and not the forest. And well, it went from us selling, you know, a few hundred of these things to thousands and thousands of them, because people were attaching them to every load, whether it had a personnel basket or, you know, anything that they were carrying below the crane. And so, you know, we started out with this, thinking this was going to be a small product, and ended up being one of the best things that we were selling in terms of volume. It was really pretty amazing. And like I said, we certainly didn't anticipate that.
That is a great story. But by the way, what makes it tangle resistant?
What we do, I try to describe it the best I can where it makes sense, but we'll take a regular 3-strand rope, just like you see it, you know, anywhere. And we take, and we stretch it out where it becomes very tight. And then we take another rope, smaller diameter, and we wrap it extremely tight where the imagine that rope, that 3-strand rope that you've got tight, and it's making a circle. Okay. I mean, it's going in circles, you know. Mm-hmm. We would attach it to an electric motor, and then we would take another rope and we would wrap that rope on there horizontally. So like you were putting a line on a fishing reel, basically.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
So we run that thing with those coils right next to each other, super tight, all the way down the whole length of that rope. Okay. So then we terminate at the end where we could do something called servet, which is a term that we use for rope where there's no knot where it terminates at the end. It's served. So it's just, there's no place at the bottom where there's anything sticking out or lumpy that can catch. So we serve it. Then we dip it in a hardener and a UV protector and a urethane. Okay. So basically, if you can imagine this now, so you've got this rope with a center rope with this other rope attached to the outside of it, or wrapped around the outside of it. So when it strikes something, the tighter the diameter gets, the more those horizontal ropes resist turning on each other, if that makes sense. So the inside diameter is basically going to keep that rope from wrapping on anything. It just physically won't do it. The rope that's wrapped around it, the tighter you pull on it to try to make it a circle, the more it fights you to make that circle. So, and then in terms of the tangle resistant part, and then the snag resistant part is the fact that we dip it and then we serve it. So there's really no way for somebody to tie a knot on the end of it, or for anything sticking out that could catch on something. So the two major areas that are a problem are, again, wrapping and snagging, and the rope won't do either one of them.
Gotcha. So it's the best of both worlds, because it sounds like it's, you know, sort of rigid enough that it's that, right? So I'm guessing there's also a little more rigidness too than a regular rope, right?
Yeah. And it's got a little bit more weight to it as well, which is nice, because if you're working offshore in any windy area, you know, if you can imagine what a small diameter rope looks like, it looks like a snake whipping around there.
Right.
This thing doesn't do that. You know, it's pretty stable. You don't want to make them too heavy, but a little bit heavy and a little bit stiff is a wonderful thing when you're working in high winds like that.
Yeah, so, I can imagine.
Yeah. So it's really, like I said, it's almost comical, that particular product, because we really didn't. That was something that was just going to be a little specialty product for our personnel nets. And it turned out to be something that we just, you know, we really had a lot of success with.
But it sounds like the genesis of it was like somebody like the X904, that you had a customer who had a problem, who sought your help. And rather than just blowing them off, you were committed to serving them and trying to help them. And you were rewarded unexpectedly with this larger market for it. Does that about summarize it?
Yeah, it does. And I think part of the advantage that my brother and I had going in is, since we didn't know anything, we knew enough to where we feel as though we could run the business on a day-to-day basis, just running it, you know, just do the right thing. But because we were always learning, we were always listening, and we were always using the people in the industry to help us, and they were very willing to help us. You know, my brother used to say, Frank used to say, you know, our learning curve is pretty much vertical. And it was, but, you know, we went from, you know, 1989, not knowing much of anything, to, you know, the last several years, you know, being considered kind of an industry expert. So, but, you know, we had the hands-on education and the opportunity to work with, golly, just about every operator and contractor I can think of. You know, I mean, the great thing about offshore oil and gas is, amongst other things, is that people are always willing to help each other. It's not one of those things where people keep their secrets, you know, close to the vest, or, you know, one driller has an advantage, you know, because they're a little bit safer, so they want anybody. No, they don't want that. They want everybody to be safe, and they want to share information to just make a better industry in general. And I just think that's unusual. I don't know how many other industries are like that, but they really do. They meet, they take care of each other, they share information. And that's been a real bonus for us too, because, you know, we'll be working a lot of times with a product with a variety of companies, and they're all very open into helping us and providing resources. You know, because when we're developing new product, then we've got to go offshore. I remember years ago when we were doing the 904, I don't think this would happen now, because many years ago, but BP actually gave me a helicopter and flew me around all over the Gulf one day. I had my own helicopter, just so that I could go, you know, check on and see how everything was working with the new 904s that were out on their platforms. And they literally, when I showed up to the shore base, the pilot was in there drinking coffee. I said, well, you know, when do we leave? He said, whenever you want to. I said, where's everybody else? He said, just me and you today, bud. Wow, that's pretty cool. So, yeah, I don't think those days are, we still have those days, but it was sure a lot of fun, man. I had a blast that day flying around the Gulf of Mexico in my own helicopter.
Sure.
So it was great.
So, the 31 year, 32 years, now, that you've been at the company, is it just all been smooth sailing, just one great success story after another, or did you guys have some challenges?
Well, you know, when you're in oil and gas, especially in offshore oil and gas, you know, it's a bumpy ride, and, you know,
because of the cyclical nature.
Yeah, it's been tough. This last, really starting about last April, has been the most difficult time in our whole company's history. And, you know, we've managed to get through it. We managed to stay financially strong through it. But you know, we thought we had been through some tough downturns. But I've talked to a lot of guys that are old enough to have been around during the downturn in the 80s, you know, the early mid 80s. And they said,
yeah,
this was much worse. You know, this one was much worse. And, I mean, to give you an idea, I mean, I talked to somebody the other day, and they were telling me that in the Gulf of Mexico, there's like two or three drilling rigs working now. I mean, back in the early 90s, it'd be 100, 120.
Wow.
And, so it's, it's just been extremely tough. And it's kind of a double-edged sword right now too, because not only, you know, with the commodity prices down, but with, you know, being oil and gas, but with COVID, you know, people weren't able to even do regular maintenance, you know, plug and abandonment stuff, pipeline stuff, you know, just upkeeping their equipment. I mean, it's just, it's really difficult. So it's been tough. I mean, we're starting to see a little bit of crack in the ice in terms of activity. I mean, we're probably busier now than we've been. Well, I know we are since COVID started, but it's been tough. I mean, we went through some downturns in the early 90s. We've probably been through three or four. You know, thank goodness, you know, we've been able to weather all of them. But yeah, that's probably been the single largest challenge for us. It's just, you know, it's frustrating sometimes when, you know, we really feel like we do a good job and we, you know, we build wonderful products and we take a ton of pride in what we do. But it doesn't matter if people aren't working offshore, they're not drilling wells and producing wells and working on ships, then we don't have anything to do. It doesn't matter what a great job we do or what great products we manufacture. If nobody's using them, you know, they don't need them. Sure. So that's probably been, in fact, it most certainly has been the most frustrating part. The wonderful part about it though, is that, you know, the core group of employees that we have has stayed with us. You know, and we're just, like I said, we're so fortunate to have them and they've stuck through it, you know, stuck with us throughout all of this. And then it hasn't been easy on anybody, including, you know, me or them. But again, like I said, we managed to get through it, you know, pretty much unscathed, I'd say. And then we're starting to see a little bit of increase in activity. So we're thankful for that.
Yeah. So I've got a question. So, you know, Warren Buffett was once asked, you know, how he was able to be successful in spite of the fact that, you know, he was not in New York. And he asserted that he was successful because he wasn't in New York. He had more time to think and there was just less going on. And it just struck me kind of a similar thing that has it been an advantage or a disadvantage all in all being in Corpus versus, say, you know, being in Houston?
You know, I think it's probably been a little bit of both. And what I mean by that is, like, from a, you know, customer access, obviously Corpus Christi is not the center point of the world for offshore oil and gas. So it's been a little bit of a disadvantage. I know from in 1996, I actually moved to Houston and just to get closer to our customers. And then Frank pretty much took care of everything that was going on at the factory. But I think from that standpoint, there would have been some real benefits to being local and to be able to not only just to have that local accessibility, but also to be able to show the customers what we do. We love having people come into our factory. I mean, that's one of the best things, because I think once they see how well organized and clean and what great attitudes our employees have and how much pride we take, I think it makes them feel better about the relationship. But the advantage to being in Corpus Christi, I believe, is we just have such an amazing workforce down there. I mean, it's just culturally, you don't have the movement, I think, that you have in big cities. The people down there, they get a good job with employers that take care of them, and they just stay, you know, they're happy. And you know, it's a kind of a small town. I mean, Corpus is a relatively big city, but it has really a small town attitude. And I just don't know that we could have operated with the kind of quality employee on a consistent basis anywhere else other than Corpus Christi. It's a wonderful place to operate a business, especially a business like ours. So, if I had to do it all over again, I wouldn't change a thing. I would definitely stay in Corpus Christi.
Okay. And how did it end up in Corpus? Is that just where Billy Pugh lived?
Yeah. Billy was from there. And okay. Strangely enough, that drilling rig, excuse me, the Mr. Gus, was working, I think off of Port Aransas right there. Just strangely enough, that's kind of where the whole personnel transfer device industry started was in Corpus Christi, just coincidentally, and Billy was from there. And so he started up on a little place up on the L Head, if you know much about Corpus, right there on the water. And then we moved over to a little factory right on Water Street that used to be the postal center where they brought in all the bulk mail. And then about 10 years ago, Frank and I went over and bought some land over by the airport, and we built a purpose-built facility over there. We have three buildings right there, about 2 miles from the airport, specifically for building Billy P products. So that's been a real nice change for us. It's a nice complex.
Okay. Well, as we're kind of rounding the home stretch of the interview, how do you decide what to do in-house and what to outsource? So, for example, like I know that like the wire rope you use, or at least some of it, I think you actually procure that from another customer of ours.
Yeah. We work with a couple of companies there locally. One is called Kennedy Wire Rope, and one is called Industrial Fabricators. And they've, you know, when you talk about a classic sales situation, I think both of them are classic sales situations that you want to, as the salesperson, that's where you want to be in the middle of. And what I mean by that is that those two companies have literally integrated themselves into our production process. We literally can't do without them. I mean, they're such an important part of our business and such an important partner. Now, Kennedy Wire Rope, for the testing that we do, you know, we have to do a lot of testing on our products. I mean, we're a little company down there in Corpus Christi, but, you know, we're ABS type approved, we're ISO 9000 approved. We have people coming in and auditing us on a regular basis, whether, you know, get someone from overseas that maybe has an order going to India or Malaysia or Indonesia, they may want to come in and send an outside inspector in. So, you know, we have to do a lot of testing, and Kennedy provides that testing for us. They provide quality products for us. When we have something that is a special need or a special new product where we need someone to work with us to design, you know, in terms of working loads, they're like a sister company to us. And Industrial Fab, the same thing. We do a lot of our own welding, but some of the welding that we do is much more technical on our products. And for instance, the aluminum weld in the X904 is very technical. And the quality standards have to be absolutely 100%. So we actually subcontract our welding on some of that more difficult stuff to them, because that's what they do. I mean, we're a manufacturer assembler, whereas they are strictly a company that does that type of work, and the quality that they give us is incredible. So those are really the two main companies that we subcontract to. We do all the assembly in-house, but the component parts, we're really tied at the hip with both of those companies, and they do an incredible job for us.
Yeah, that's always interesting, because you like contrast that with like Elon Musk at Tesla, where he's trying to vertically integrate as much as he can. And, you know, Henry Ford, that was his whole thing, was to try to be as vertically integrated. But I know that, you know, starting, you know, 20 years ago or so, there was a new theory that sort of evolved of, you know, focus on what you do best and outsource the rest. So it kind of sounds like you subscribe to that second mindset of what you do really well.
Yeah, I mean, if we had the expertise that those guys have, and we wanted to invest that kind of money, then we probably would vertically integrate. But because they're right there, they provide such good service and quality, From an investment standpoint, it's just much more economical for us to work with those guys and have them subcontract those component parts. You know, they don't do any finished parts for us, but they do such a wonderful job on the component parts. They're right in the middle of our QAQC program, so it's just been a great relationship.
Okay.
So,
And I know that, and I know you outsource some other specialty services. Like, you know, I know we've done some, you know, worked on some different tax projects for you guys. How do you decide on you know, when to do that kind of stuff in house, or have your CPA firm do it, or outsource it to someone like us?
Well, I tell you, I do want to go on, go public with how pleased we've been, you know, working with you guys on our IC Disc program. You know, I don't know, Dave, how many years you and I talked about it, but, you know, we used to meet up at OTC and you know, you would tell me about this IC Disc program. And I think something changed in the law or something that made it, I don't remember all that stuff, but that made it more, you know, relative to a company like ours. Was there a law change or something? What changed where we got going on this? Was it just me making a decision, or was it something that actually happened?
I think what it was, there was a predecessor program that went away in 2006. And that program was really easy. And the DISC was just way more, there was way more complexity to it. And I think that when you were comparing the DISC to the old program, it just seemed so complex that I think it just created some resistance. And so I think that's just what it was. It was just, you know, you guys had a lot of other stuff going on, and on the surface, it just seemed so complicated. But,
well, you should have been more aggressive with us, you know, because it, you know, once we got going, you know, we saved a tremendous amount of money. And, you know, being a small US based company that exports most of our equipment, you know, it was, you know, to not take advantage of that, would not have made any sense. And we're just, you know, like I said, it was a very, very successful program. And in terms of outsourcing other stuff, it just kind of depends. You know, we have a CPA firm that we worked with for many years, and they do a great job. And so we kind of believe in, like you said earlier, you know, we kind of like bringing in people that are experts in their field and finding the very best one that makes a fit with us, and then utilizing their products and services. And then we really believe in the relationship part of it as well. You know, once we develop relationships, we try to keep them for a long time. And just about, well, everybody that I'm, you know, whether it's you or our CPA, which is Austin Adamson, or Kennedy Wire Rope, or, I mean, we've done business with all those people for many, many, many years. And you know, they just provide great products and services. And you know, like I said, the relationship is a big part of that.
Well, I know for me, it's a lot more fun doing business that way, where, you know, where you're not just, you know, beating up. You know, so I've always looked at it as I view our suppliers as just as important as our customers. And, you know, as far as those relationships, because you need both to be successful. So I can appreciate that. Well, can you believe that we're almost an hour in?
No. Well, you told me it was going to go fast, and it did. I've got notes here. I didn't even get to half of this stuff.
I know. But, we may have to have you on for a round two then. I appreciate you, you taking time to be on the podcast. Was there anything, that I didn't ask you that you wish I'd asked you?
Well, you know, we're just quickly, you know, we're real proud of the fact that we, you know, this goes back before I got there, but it's still attached to Billy Pugh Company, and we designed the rescue system for the Apollo missions. And so if you watch any of those old Apollo movies, you know, about, I think the ones Tom Hanks and all those guys were in, where they, when the, capsule dropped into the ocean, they actually dropped a Billy Pugh Company, helicopter rescue basket down there to pick up the astronauts. And the one that, was used for the Apollo, moon missions, is in the Smithsonian. So we're a little company down there in Corpus Christi. Yeah. But we've got our own little display, purpose-built display by the Smithsonian that has our, it's called an X-872SF helicopter rescue device, in there. So yeah, we're really proud of that. And the fact that our company's in the offshore oil and gas hall of fame in Galveston, we, you know, we'll probably, if you go down there and you want to see a drilling rig, you walk in the front door and there's a first thing you see is a Billy Pugh Company X904 right in the front door. So,
you mentioned that.
Well, thanks. Yeah. But you know, those things, and, you know, we've developed a lot of other products, maybe not as financially successful as the X904, but certainly things that have created a safer work environment for the offshore oil and gas business. And like I said, we just feel real blessed to have the relationships that we do and the trust of the industry. So it's been a great 31 years and coming up on 32 years, and hopefully we'll have 32 more good ones.
Well, I hope so. Well, Paul, well, just on a more personal note, I just really wanted to thank you for the giving us the opportunity to help you all for the last 15 years or so. And also just want to thank you for your friendship too. You've been, become, you know, really one of my favorite, people. So I just want to thank you for that.
Well, thanks, David. Feeling is mutual, and I appreciate you having me be a part of your podcast. It means a lot. Thank you.
All right. Well, with that, we will wrap up. And Paul, I hope you have a great afternoon.
Great. You do the same. Thanks, Dave. Take care.
All right. Bye.
There we have it. Another great episode. Thanks for listening in. If you want to continue the conversation, go to icdiscshow.com. That's icdiscshow.com. And we have additional information on the podcast, archived episodes, as well as a button to be a guest. So if you'd like to be a guest, go select that and fill out the information, and we'd love to have you on the show. So that's it. We'll be back next time with another episode of the IC Disc Show.